The headlines: the UN mission in Afghanistan raises the death toll from an attack targeting an exam center in Kabul to 35. Tens of thousands of rail workers in Britain walk off the job, paralyzing train services, and protest over pay and working conditions. And the Palestinian Resistance Front warns Tel Aviv of a heavy confrontation after Israeli military officials threatened to assassinate resistance leaders. Well, welcome to our studios here in the capital, Tehran. This is News. Thanks for joining us. In Afghanistan, Hazara women and civil rights activists rally in the capital, Kabul, to condemn recent terrorist attacks against the Shia Hazara community. The protesters chanted "Stop the Hazara genocide" and "We want justice" while marching on the streets. The rally was staged a day after a suicide attack targeted an educational center in an area mainly populated by the Hazara community in western Kabul. According to the UN mission in that country, the blast left nearly 35 people dead and many more injured. Many of those killed were teenage girls who were getting extra tuition, preparation for university entrance exams. Journalist Said Zafar Mehdi says terror attacks in Afghanistan continue unabated without receiving a worldwide condemnation.
Unfortunately, you know, as you can see, there are no hashtags for them. No condemnation, no press marches, no candlelight vigils, no probes. And this cycle of violence, this unending cycle of violence, targeting them has somehow been normalized over the years. And this is a country that has never seen peace. You know, if you go back in history, it was British, then it was Soviets, then it was Americans and their allies, and now it's Daesh. Daesh is, of course, a proxy of Western powers that has filled this vacuum left by U.S.-led NATO forces. I see blood of these innocents killed in yesterday's attack in this predominantly Shia neighborhood of Dasht-e-Bashti in western Kabul in the hands of Americans. You know, they are responsible for this mess, for the rise and resurgence of this terrorist group. You know, since 2014, when this Daesh terrorist group made first inroads in the country, they have been relentlessly bombing mosques, schools, hospitals, you know, that belong to this community. Dasht-e-Bashti and other smaller pockets which are inhabited by Shias in Kabul have been the main targets. I myself have survived at least two such attacks when I was stationed in Kabul as a journalist some years ago.
On to Iraq, where scuffles have broken out between protesters and security forces. Thousands of people gathered to mark the third anniversary since anti-government protests that shook the country in 2019. Protesters gathered at the Al-Jumhuriyah Bridge in the capital, Baghdad. They threw stones and tried to break down barriers. Police retaliated by using tear gas to disperse the crowd. Over 40 people have been injured, including policemen. In 2019, protests erupted against then-Prime Minister Adel Abdel Mahdi's government. Demonstrators demanded an overhaul of the political system, which they believe is profoundly corrupt and keeps people in poverty. Iraq has been mired in political paralysis that has left the country without a head of state and government since October of last year. A teacher in Italy risks a disciplinary sanction for cutting off an Iranian student's hair. The man did this after the minor refused to show solidarity for the protests taking place in Iran. Our correspondent Max Civilli has more.
The High School of Human Sciences Leonardo da Vinci is located in central Rome, not far from the Colosseum. The school has a good reputation. It offers a mix of classical and modern studies and a cultural background which, reads its website, allows pupils to access any university faculty. However, earlier this week, one of Leonardo da Vinci's teachers cut a lock of hair from an Iranian student after urging her to express solidarity with the protests taking place in Iran. The underage girl had remained unresponsive to the teacher's request.
We were shocked at the teacher's behavior. It targeted an Iranian minor because of her nationality and made the student feel that expressing solidarity was an act due for her. An act of exclusion from the class was then turned into an act of violence when the teacher humiliated the student by cutting a lock of her hair.
The teacher was addressing his pupils on the issue of protests in Iran that have been going on for days after the tragic death of 22-year-old girl Mahsa Amini. On Friday, we reached the principal of the Leonardo da Vinci School, but she politely refused to be interviewed, saying that Italy's education authority has forbidden all school staff from engaging with the media on the issue. The teacher involved in the case risks now a disciplinary sanction. Even the mayor of Rome, Roberto Gualtieri, has said the episode concerning the Iranian student, if confirmed, would be an unacceptable form of bullying.
Sicuramente c'è una violenza.
For sure there was violence in the way the teacher behaved. The whole story revolves around someone who has been bullied and their attacker. In between were the other students stunned, petrified, because of the teacher's gesture. They suddenly acted as if they were attendants. They were passive, resigned, a common attitude in our society.
The fact that a teacher, who is someone who should encourage free thinking and the natural reflection of wanting to do something for oneself, I don't know, I think it was absolutely unnecessary, and they should definitely face some consequences.
Also, the National Association of Principals of Rome has condemned the teacher's gesture, saying that teachers should always act with great caution and that principals must ensure that schools are a place of growth and not a place where one looks for media exposure. Max Civili, Rome.
British commuters are facing travel chaos as tens of thousands of railway workers go on a strike in disputes over pay and job security. This is the largest one-day rail strike in decades, involving three major trade unions and more than 50,000 workers across the country. Officials say only around 11% of train services will operate on Saturday. In some parts, there will be no trains at all. The strike will also hamper travel to the ruling Conservative Party's annual conference in Birmingham, due to begin tomorrow. Our London correspondent Syed Pourreza joined us with more details on the British railway workers' strike and their key demands.
And it looks like the so-called summer of discontent has spilled over into autumn. Of course, the strike that is happening today had been planned for September, but the death of the late monarch Queen Elizabeth II delayed everything. Other strikes are planned for later in the month. There are two sides to this dispute over pay, pensions, and new conditions. One is the unions. One of them we've been talking about a lot is the RMT, the Railway Maritime and Transport Union, very powerful union headed by Mick Lynch, the General Secretary, and a number of other unions. And on the other side, you have National Network Rail, rather, which is the public arm of the UK's transportation ministry. They have been debating over a pay rise for months now. Those negotiations are still rumbling on, and there doesn't seem to be a consensus or a settlement in sight just yet. What the unions are asking for their workers, drivers, more than 53,000 of whom are on strike today, hence the situation the country is facing, is they want a pay rise that is in keeping with the inflation rate that is in the double digits.
And staying with the UK, people are rallying in all major cities across the country to protest against the rising living costs. In the capital, London, people are gathering in a number of places, including Queen's Gardens and Hull City Centre, to call for action. Representatives from the opposition Labour Party and trade unionists are scheduled to give speeches. People have called on celebrities to join in. They demand higher pay for workers and taxes on the rich. The cost of living has been increasing across the UK since early 2021. The annual rate of inflation reached nearly 10% in August 2022, close to a 30-year high. The increase affected the affordability of goods and services for households. Palestinian resistance groups have warned the Israeli regime against any attempt to target their senior members. The group said that Tel Aviv should be awaiting a tough military response if it carries out its threat to assassinate Palestinian commanders. They said Israeli troops will face death if they attack the Jenin refugee camp north of the occupied West Bank. Jenin has been the focal point of an Israeli crackdown against Palestinians in recent months. The Palestinian groups also warned that Israeli troops will die both inside their armored vehicles and on the streets as a result of heavy fire by resistance groups. The warning comes after Chief of the General Staff of the Israeli military, Aviv Kochavi, threatened to assassinate senior Palestinian commanders. My correspondent from Ramallah, Mona Kandil, says the Israeli regime is preventing Palestinian resistance groups from conducting any activities in the occupied West Bank.
The Israeli regime is completely refusing any move by the Palestinian armed groups or by the Palestinian resistance movement or any kind of Palestinian activities in the occupied West Bank. They want to prevent any action of activities, any form of resistance against the Israeli forces and the Israeli soldiers. And from here, the Israeli troops continue to raid Palestinian areas on a daily basis. Confrontations take place between Palestinians and Israeli soldiers. And at the end of the day, let's say at least every week, a number of Palestinians are being killed. Those whom the Israelis claim they are wanted for security reasons. At the end of the day, those are Palestinians engaged in different forms of resistance. They are members of the different Palestinian, Palestinian resistance groups. But the move and the thing that is dangerous now, the Israelis might not be going to confrontations or clashes. They are choosing the easy way. The easy way for the Israeli soldiers is to assassinate the leaders and activists of the Palestinian resistance groups in the occupied West Bank, of course.
The Russian move on the four Ukrainian regions has been met with a backlash by some Western countries in the U.N. Security Council. During our news review program, we discussed that with our guest. Let's take a listen.
And I welcome everyone to our news review program, where we get in-depth in one of the day's top stories. And now Russia has vetoed a Western-backed resolution at the United Nations Security Council, which condemns its annexation of four Ukrainian territories. The resolution, co-sponsored by the United States, aimed to isolate Russia in its war in Ukraine. It would have called on Moscow to immediately withdraw its forces from Ukrainian territories. China, Brazil, India, and Gabon abstained from the vote. During the Security Council session, the U.S. ambassador said the U.N. was built on the idea of not allowing a country to take another's territory by force. The Russian ambassador to the UN pushed back by condemning U.S.-initiated resolution as a hostile action. Ambassador Vasilina Benzia said there will be no turning back for annexation of the Ukrainian territories, arguing locals made an informed and free choice to join Russia. And joining us now for the program is Scott Bennett, political commentator, joining us out of San Francisco, California. Mr. James Jotras, former U.S. Senate foreign policy analyst, joining us from Virginia. Gentlemen, I'd like to welcome you both to the program. Mr. Jotras, we're going to start with you, sir, if we may. Good to have you on. Your thoughts on what this resolution was supposed to accomplish. Obviously, many knew it was going to get basically either vetoed down or shot down by other countries, considering Russia's a world power and carries that veto, so does China. So what was the whole point of it, Mr. Joshua? What was the point the U.S. was trying to make, and to what end?
It was political theater, of course. It was simply to have a resolution that would condemn Russia, that Russia would, of course, veto. I think the downside for the American policy is that not only China, which was to be expected, but that India and Brazil would not support the resolution. And of course, Russia doesn't need them to vote on its side. It just needs them not to vote on the American side. So I don't think this is actually a very big plus for Washington in this regard.
Right. Really quick, I'm gonna welcome Scott. Scott, welcome to the program there. But your initial thoughts on the story, Scott?
Well, you know, the independence of Luhansk, Donetsk, Crimea, and eastern Ukraine is simply following the Declaration of Independence that the United States of America made in 1776. The Ukrainian people have held that all men are created equal, that they're endowed by their creator for life, liberty, and the pursuit of happiness. And they saw their only way of containing and maintaining their lives was to join Russia and escape the clutches of the demoniac Zelensky and his Nazi hordes. So it's fascinating in the hypocrisy and the lies when the U.S. condemns people seeking to preserve their lives and preserve their language and culture
and follow traditional family values and marriage between a man and a woman, and not worshiping the environment and a slavish climate change religion. This is the future of a healthy humanity in the direction that Russia and these republics are going. And I think Europe is about to totally collapse economically. That's what the United States is engineering through its act of terrorism and blowing up the natural gas pipeline. So I wouldn't be surprised if Russia retaliates by pulling out all diplomatic conversations, tearing the phone out of the wall, and having nothing to do with the United States, and making an appeal saying all people in Europe and America that want family values and truth and freedom, come to Russia, because it's obvious now you're in a police state of madness and hypocrisy and lies, and that is a nation and a hemisphere that is doomed to be destroyed by God because of their hypocrisy, their sin, and their wickedness. So I think Russia is being blessed and being raised up on a very high pedestal, and the rest of the nations are recognizing it, and they're turning from the United States in favor of Russia.
Gentlemen, thank you both. It's always a pleasure to check in with both of you. Scott Bennett, they're joining us from San Francisco, and Mr. James Jotras joining us out of Virginia. And that brings us to the conclusion of your news review program. Thank you for tuning in, and goodbye for now.
And that is for this edition of World News. It's bye-bye for now.
This is IRIB English Radio. Please log on to our website, www.parstoday.com/en. Thank you.
ocean of dua.
أعوذ بالله من الشيطان الرجيم. بسم الله الرحمن الرحيم. الحمد لله رب العالمين، ثم الصلاة والسلام على سيدنا محمد وآله الطاهرين. Hello everyone, brothers and sisters. I am Sayyid Muhammad Hassan Mudarrisi with you with another edition of the program, The Ocean of Dua. In this edition of the program, we'll have a glance at Kumail's supplication and we'll discuss a commentary on that. We'll be back in a few seconds, so stay tuned.
Ya Ilahi wa Rabbi wa Sayyidi wa Mawlai li ayy al-umuri ilayka ashku wa lima minha
Dear listeners, we have reached this part of the supplication of Kumail.
Ya Ilahi wa Rabbi wa Sayyidi wa Mawlai, my Lord, my Master, my Protector, li ayyil umur ilayka ashku wa lima minha adijju abki, for which things would I complain to you, and for which of them would I lament and weep?
Li alim al adhab wa shiddatih, for the pain and severity of the chastisement,
أم لطول البلاء ومدته,
or for the length and period of the tribulation.
We said that the commander of the believers, in this part of the supplication, is complaining about the tribulations and the chastisements. And he is in fact telling us that this is the only one we should refer to for our complaints, because he is the one who has saved many prophets, many infallible imams, many believers and the repentant ones. He has saved them all from their problems. Because which patient do we know that has come toward Allah, but Allah did not cure him? O God, which poor one came to you, but you did not enrich him? Which unfortunate came to you, but you did not fulfill his desire? Which supplicant has come to you, but you did not grant him his wish? Which needy one has come to you, but you returned with his problem unsolved? Which repentant one came to you without his repentance being accepted? You are the one who accept them all. You are the one who cure them all. You are the one who enrich them all. You are the absolute cause. And we are complaining to you alone and no one else. We have come to you to lament and weep.
My God, my Lord, my King and Master, which of the matters shall I complain to you, and for which of them shall I wail and weep? Shall I wail for the pains of the punishment and its intensity, or for the length of my suffering and its duration?
Thank you, Allah. So good about all the things that we went through, knowing that God is pleased with us too. It's not a dream, this is so true, and we know we'll be here forever. The feeling is indescribable, knowing that this is our reward.
The ocean of dua.
So in this part of the Kumail supplication, Imam Ali alayhi salam is weeping, lamenting.
وَلِمَا مِنْهَا أَضِجُّ وَأَبْكِي,
for which of the things would I lament and weep? This weeping, this lamenting, when we consider it from a different perspective, is one of Allah's greatest gifts to the servants. Because weeping implies that the heart is really humble. And when weeping is for the sake of God, this implies the heart's humbleness to Allah and a pure spirit. The Holy Quran has considered weeping a sign of the believers and Allah's lovers. The Holy Quran says, وَإِذَا سَمِعُوا مَا أُنزِلَ إِلَى الرَّسُولِ تَرَى أَعْيُنَهُمْ تَفِيضُ مِنَ الدَّمْعِ مِمَّا عَرَفُوا مِنَ الْحَقِّ. And when they hear what has been revealed to the messenger, you will see their eyes overflowing with fears on account of the truth that they recognize. يَقُولُونَ رَبَّنَا آمَنَّا فَاكْتُبْنَا مَعَ الشَّهَدِينَ. They say, our Lord, we believe, so write us down with the witness of the truth. The Messenger of Allah, sallallahu alayhi wa alayhi wa sallam, once told Imam Ali alayhi salam, أُوصِيكَ يَا عَلِي فِي نَفْسِكَ بِخِصَالٍ فَحْفَظْهَا. O Ali, I recommend you to develop and maintain some characteristics in yourself. And the Prophet asks Allah's help for him. He says, Allahumma a'inhu, he prays for him. May Allah help you. One of those things is al-buka'u lillah yabni laka bikulli dam'atin baytan fil jannah. One of those characteristics is weeping for the sake of Allah, the Holy Prophet tells Imam Ali alayhi salam. Because for each of your teardrops, a house is given to you in paradise. Our tradition books are replete with words of the infallibles about how important weeping and lamenting for the sake of Allah is. The Holy Prophet sallallahu alaihi wa alihi wasallam has also stated, طُوبَى لِصُورَةٍ نَظَرَ اللَّهُ إِلَيْهَا تَبْكِي عَلَى ذَنْبٍ مِنْ خَشْيَةِ اللَّهِ عَزَّ وَجَلَّ لَمْ يَطَّلِعْ عَلَى ذَلِكَ الذَّنْبِ غَيْرُهُ. Blessed is the one to whose face Allah has regard while he is weeping for his sin out of Allah's fear, and no one else knows of that sin but Allah. There is also another word from the Holy Prophet sallallahu alayhi wa alayhi wa sallam, and let us end our discussion in this episode with this beautiful word of the Prophet. He says, مَنْ ذَرَفَتْ عَيْنَاهُ مِنْ خَشْيَةِ اللَّهِ. The reward of someone whose eyes weep for Allah's fear, كَانَ لَهُ بِكُلِّ قَطْرَةٍ مِّن دُمُوعِهِ مِثْلُ جَبَلِ أُحُدْ يَكُونُ فِي مِيزَانِهِ مِنَ الْأَجْرِ. The one whose eyes weep for Allah's fear will get this reward, a mount as heavy as Mount Uhud for any drop. This is his reward. Thank you, brothers and sisters, for staying with us in this episode. We ask the Almighty Allah to set us among the guided ones and the people of the straight path. Wassalamu alaikum wa rahmatullahi wa barakatuh.
Thank you, dear listeners of IRIB English, for listening to us. If you have any question regarding our programs, feel free to email us at englishradio@irib.ir. Also visit our website at parsetoday.com. Until the next program, take care and goodbye.
Don't let me go astray, cause I need you by my side. I wish to be close to you through half my life. Ya Allah, oh Allah, be with me.
Hello, I'm Mubarak Kenya, and a big welcome to this week's edition of Africa Today.
Stay tuned with Africa Today.
Africa Today.
The Israeli regime's ambassador to Morocco was recently entangled in sexual harassment and corruption at the regime's mission in Rabat. Now, the scandal comes nearly 2 years after the North African country normalized its ties with Tel Aviv. Now, this gross misconduct angered the people of Morocco, leading to demonstrations, and eventually Israel was forced to sack its errant envoy. Even before the latest scandal, Moroccans have been holding regular protests against the normalization of ties with the Israeli regime. Here is one such protest. Hello, I'm Mubarak Kenya, and a warm welcome to Africa Today, a weekly program that gives you an alternative view of news and events making headlines in Africa. In the first part of our program today, we are focusing on the sexual abuse of Moroccan women by the Israeli regime's envoy in the country. Following this latest scandal, the people in Morocco held rallies rejecting ties between their country and the Israeli regime. The second part of our program will be on the recent general elections in Kenya that have been touted as a success story in a continent that has seen a wave of military takeovers and political turmoil. Stay with us as our experts give us their incisive analysis on today's subjects and be part of our conversation by sending your comments through our social media handle.
Moroccans protest misconduct by Israeli envoy. The people of Morocco have rallied against ties between their country and the Israeli regime, condemning David Govrin, the regime's envoy in Rabat, for the sexual abuse of Moroccan women. Irate Moroccans marched outside parliament in the capital Rabat against the North African country's normalization of relations with the Israeli regime after Tel Aviv. Following the protests, Israel had no option but to sack its ambassador amid an investigation over the sex abuse scandal.
The masses in Morocco have been resolute in opposing the normalization of ties with the Israeli regime. Now, the regime in Morocco uses brutal force to clamp down on anti-normalization protests, but the masses have not relented in resisting ties with the Israeli regime. Well, to discuss the latest scandal at the Israeli regime's embassy in Morocco, we have contacted Khalid Berekat, a journalist and activist. Thanks a lot for joining us today, sir.
Thank you for having me.
Now, our first question, what is your take on the sex scandal involving the Israeli regime's envoy in Rabat, which of course is not surprising coming from an Israeli?
Well, this scandal is just one of many scandals, actually. The scandals we hear about is the one that is exposed by either the press or, you know, Moroccan political and social forces in Morocco. The problem is that this is business as usual between the Morocco regime and the Israeli regime. There has been many, many scandals and bigger one, in fact, crimes, and it was joint crimes between the Moroccan regime and the Israeli regime. This is a reflection of popular position in Morocco, who does not want any kind of relationship with Israel. These scandals are carried by the Israeli ambassadors and officials, especially on the sexual harassment, the corruption is also part of Israel infiltrating Arab societies through normalization.
Govrin is facing allegations of exploiting several Moroccan women, sexual harassment, and indecent exposure. There were also complaints of sexual harassment within the mission. Demonstrators who burned an Israeli flag at their protest rally denounced both 59-year-old Govrin and Moroccan Foreign Minister Nasser Bourita. The Israeli regime's envoy clearly does not respect or care about the dignity of the people of Morocco, and especially women in this Muslim nation. The acts by the envoy further reveal the immoral and evil nature of officials of the Israeli regime.
Well, they don't care about the dignity of the woman in Morocco, but they also don't even care about Moroccan Jews who are in Palestine. They have Israel, the Israeli regime is a racist regime built on Western hegemony, and they we see what they do to Moroccans, whether they're Palestinian from Moroccan roots in Jerusalem, and the way they treat Palestinians who comes from Morocco historically, and also the way they degrade even Moroccan Jews inside, quote unquote Israel. So this is not new. And so to be in Morocco and to have these policies and these practices against the Moroccan woman is just part of the Israeli nature regime.
The sex scandal involving the Israeli regime's envoy in Morocco was expected to ignite a serious diplomatic dispute between Rabat and Tel Aviv. However, the monarchy in Morocco has treated the serious matter casually, and this has further angered Moroccans. Now, why has the monarchy in Morocco failed to take stern action against the Israeli regime's envoy, yet he brazenly disrespected the dignity, beliefs, and the culture of Moroccans?
See, we have to understand the relationship between the the regime in Morocco and the Zionist regime. This is a relationship that goes back to the 50s. Morocco has always depended on Israel to even assassinate some of the oppositions of the king. For example, the known leader, Mehdi Nebreka, who was assassinated in France in October 29, 1965, at the hands of the both Israelis and Moroccan intelligence. Many operations has been carried by both regimes. The Morocco regime have a very strong relationship with Israel since the 60s, but it was always hidden. Now, in 2006 and 2007, there were so many records released exposing the Moroccan regime relationship with the Zionist regime. And this is a relationship that is under the wing of the United States. These are allies of the United States.
The Israeli regime and Morocco agreed on December 10, 2020, to normalize relations in a deal brokered with the help of the administration of former U.S. President Donald Trump, making the North African country the fourth Arab state to recently normalize with the regime. The others were the United Arab Emirates, Bahrain, and Sudan. The people of Morocco have always supported the liberation of Palestinian territories occupied by the Israeli regime and have therefore categorically rejected normalization of ties with the Israeli regime.
Normalization of ties with the Israeli regime has not only humiliated the people of Morocco, but has also failed to bring any tangible economic benefits, and the people have been holding protests over rising prices. Now, the normalization deal has worsened the economic situation in Morocco, and the people are not happy. Why is the monarchy in Morocco adamant about maintaining ties with the Israeli regime?
Because the regime and the ruling class of Morocco believe that the only way to sustain the regime and to keep it alive is by strengthening their relationship with the United States and with Israel and with other Arab reactionary regimes. And so it's a part of a camp that depends solely on this relationship. I mean, the crimes that the regime have committed against the people of Morocco and the people of Western Sahara, the crimes of the regime against the revolution in Algeria, you know, by conspiring against the leadership of the revolution in Algeria, the atrocities that the regime has participated in so many different places in the Arab world. So this is just not a regime that plays a role in Morocco. It also has its dirty hands all over the place. And people in Morocco actually know that this regime is there by force and by the help and the assistance of foreign power, particularly the United States and Israel and the Gulf.
Well, there you have it. The ruling monarchy in Morocco is being sustained by foreign powers, especially the United States and the Israeli entity, against the will of the masses. I would like to thank our guest, Khalid Barakat, a journalist and activist, for his incisive analysis today. We'll now take a short break before our next segment of our show, which is on the recent general elections in Kenya. Stay with us.
Kenya's elections setting trends for Africa.
You're listening to Africa Today. Africa Today is an analytical weekly review of political, economic, and social events in Africa, the world's second largest continent. The series is broadcast every week on Saturdays and Sundays by IRIB English Radio.
William Ruto was sworn in as Kenya's fifth president on Tuesday, 30 September, a week after the country's Supreme Court rejected a challenge by his opponent in a close-fought election. Ruto received 50.5% of the vote against 48.8% for Raila Odinga.
Ruto was President Uhuru Kenyatta's vice president, but the two fell out and Kenyatta backed opposition leader Raila Odinga in the vote. Ruto, the son of a peasant, won by portraying himself as an underdog hustler, battling political dynasties and the elite in this East African nation.
He was sworn in as Kenya's fifth president in Nairobi at a 60,000-seat stadium that was filled before dawn. The ceremony was also attended by regional leaders and representatives from across the world. For more on the recent peaceful transition of power in Kenya after closely contested general elections, we have contacted Julius Mbaluto, a journalist and an African affairs analyst. Thanks a lot for your time today. Now, the recent elections in Kenya have been described as an example of a successful democratic experience in the region and the wider African continent. Now, do you agree with this viewpoint?
I definitely agree to that kind of observation. Definitely. Kenyans went to vote, and it was a peaceful electoral process. And then, of course, you have the outcome of the election, announcement of president-elect. All that was peacefully done. And, of course, although results were not pleasant to everybody, half the country were like, our candidate has lost, the other one was, our candidate has won. That didn't bring any problems, no fighting, nothing.
International election observers commended the people of Kenya and the Electoral Commission for conducting free, fair, and credible elections. Former Tanzania President Jakaya Kikwete, who led the East African Community EAC Observer Mission, told a press briefing in Nairobi that he was satisfied with the process.
It's African Community Election Observation Mission is satisfied that the way the 2022 general election, Kenyan general election, was conducted on polling day, the people of Kenya were given the opportunity to elect leaders of their choice freely.
The electoral process in Kenya was closely monitored across Africa as it set a new and higher electoral bar for the country and the rest of the continent. South Africa's Minister of International Relations, Dr. Naledi Pandor, commended the aggrieved parties in Kenya for going the legal route to challenge the results.
So as long as you have an independent electoral authority that conducts itself in terms of the law, you should have successful processes. And should there be any concern by parties that things didn't go the right way, there must be a legal route to follow. And that's what's happening in Kenya.
Kenya previously had incidents of deadly violence after elections. But this year, the post-election period was peaceful, even after the Supreme Court upheld Ruto's victory. Analysts say this indicates that Kenyan democracy has finally come of age.
Kenyans kept telling their presidential candidates, whatever the Supreme Court says, go back. If you go back for election, we're going to vote for you. But don't tell us to fight each other. So Kenyans swore never to fight for, you know, each other because of an election of sorts. And that's something which is really important. Also, Kenyans over the time, when they experience with their democracy, they have come to understand politicians. Because what politicians are, they're like men in a game or women in a game. And you see, they will like say anything, do anything to paint their opponent in the wrong, you know, in the wrong direction or in the wrong picture. So when you look at them, oh, fine. And you see them as your enemy. You deem them to be your enemy. But Kenyans are seen behind the scenes.
President Ruto has admitted that the expectations of the people of Kenya are huge and his administration will not have the luxury of wasting time. Now, are the people of Kenya optimistic that this government will meet their expectations?
From the way they kicked off, hasn't been pleasant to everybody. They criticized the current regime in power. They criticized the former government of making the cost of living so expensive for everybody. Of course, to the level that the former government had to subsidize price commodities for food, basically, and also in terms of fuel, also they did that. But this particular government now in power, they used to promise Kenyans, when we get into power, life will be cheaper. We are going to bring things, make things cheaper.
Well, many analysts, just like Mr. Mbaluto, have criticized the scrapping of subsidies by the new administration. However, President Ruto has elaborated on the reasons for the removal of fuel subsidies.
In addition to being very costly, consumption subsidy interventions are prone to abuse. They distort markets and create uncertainty, including artificial shortages of the very products they seek to subsidize. The cost of living challenges are related, in our respectful submission, to production. Our strategy to bring down the cost of living is predicated on empowering producers.
The congratulatory messages to Kenya's new government from leaders of other countries in Africa and globally are pointer that the world is eager to deepen engagements with President Ruto. During his inauguration speech, he highlighted some of his foreign policy priorities.
Kenya will continue, ladies and gentlemen, to be a dedicated partner to peace, security, and prosperity of East Africa region. We look forward to deepening our integration. We welcome our newest member, the DRC, whose entry now extends our region from the Indian Ocean to the Atlantic. Kenya is fully committed to the implementation of the East African Community Treaty and its protocols of free movement of people, goods, and services. Equally important is our commitment to the full actualization of the Africa Continental Free Trade Area. Ladies and gentlemen, Kenya will continue playing its role in international diplomacy at the bilateral and multilateral levels, appreciating that we are host to major international agencies, including the United Nations.
In his official address, soon after his swearing in, Ruto said his administration will prioritize tackling unemployment through various measures. Let's take a listen.
Jobs, ladies and gentlemen, is our other priority. It is time for us to stem the tide of youth unemployment. Every year, 800,000 young people join the workforce, and over 600,000 of them do not find opportunities for productive work. Our immediate agenda is to create a favorable business and enterprise environment, decriminalize livelihoods, and support people in the informal sector to organize themselves into stable, viable, and creditworthy business entities.
Domestically, the priorities of William Ruto's administration are expected to focus on the immediate uplifting of the living standards across the country, particularly because he portrayed himself as a hustler and a champion of the poor in his campaign for the presidency. Now, our last question, will the policies announced by President Ruto alleviate the economic challenges many Kenyans are facing, especially unemployment?
Yeah, policies are key to drive any government. Formulation of policy takes a lot of consultation if it's going to have impact with the masses of the people. And I think right now what matters in Kenya, whichever way you look at it, ordinary folks, they're like, you are pricing life so much away from our reach. Number one, all food commodities have to come down. That's whether you like it or not, to make it affordable to ordinary folks. Number two, fuel prices, whatever they have to do, stop blaming Ukraine, Russia. Think about locally. What can you do so that you don't keep saying Russia, Ukraine? War is the one that's causing all this pain. No, no excuses, no scapegoats. The government has to do something, if it is to subsidize oil, to bring it low because it affects everything else. Number one, that's what ordinary folks want to see. Number three, the policies that are crafted by this regime, they have to be very focused on those people who are struggling in terms of health.
Well, our guest there says that the newly elected government of Kenya will need to focus on alleviating economic hardships facing the people in this most advanced economy in East and Central Africa. Thank you very much, Julius Mbaluto, for your time today. And that brings us to the end of this week's edition of Africa Today. Goodbye for now.
You have just listened to the Voice of the Islamic Republic of Iran broadcasting. The Voice of the Islamic Republic of Iran is broadcast daily from 1920 to 2020 UTC on the following frequencies. 31 meters, 9,855 kilohertz for Europe, and 31 meters, 9,835 kilohertz for Southern Africa, and FM 91.5 megahertz for Tehran. You can also listen to the Voice of the Islamic Republic of Iran on Hotbird, Eutelsat 3B, and IranSat or Bat 5, and via the internet. Our internet address is parstoday.com/en. And now you can listen to IRIB English Radio via your mobile phone. Please refer to our website for the details.
This is IRIB English Radio. Coming up is the news.